since 1775,
generations of Americans have fought
for our ideals and our principles.
American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world.
Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen,
soldiers,
sailors,
marines,
airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun
at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged.
This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose.
It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041.
The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here for a very, I tell you, I always say every segment is special, but folks, you are absolutely going to want to stick around for this one. We are talking to history. Our guests may not agree with that, but hey, listen, Jeff and Fred, great show. I had a chance to meet Alan Day down in Tubac a couple weeks ago. If you get a chance, please pick up his book, The Horse Lover. It is a very, very compelling story. I think you'll enjoy it. So, onward. Let me introduce this really quick. On about 18 minutes in the after 10 o'clock in the morning on April 2nd, 1942, the aircraft carrier USS Hornet steamed underneath San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge with 16 B-25 bombers on her deck. Civilians looking on probably thought that she was just ferrying bombers out to someplace in the Pacific. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor just 4 months earlier. The reality was that she was heading for a position 500 nautical miles off the coast of Japan to execute a top-secret mission that would become part of military aviation history. As I mentioned, just 4 months prior, the Japanese had launched an attack on Pearl Harbor, driving the U.S. into World War II. While not crippled, the Pacific Fleet was severely wounded, including the loss of our very own USS Arizona, with 1,177 sailors on board. Across America, there was shock, there was fear, there was a lot of anger. Morale was low, and the public was looking for a response. President Roosevelt was also looking for a response, but we didn't have land bases sufficiently close to Japan to mount an attack from a bombing attack, a reprisal attack, and using the already crippled Pacific Fleet was risky at best. Let's move forward a little bit. In January 1942, a captain by the name of Francis Lowe, he was a submariner, was visiting Norfolk, Virginia to review the Navy's newest aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet. That Navy field had an outline of an aircraft carrier painted on the landing field that helped the aviators practice their landing, takeoff and landing. But he also observed some B-25 bombers practicing mock attacks on that painted outline. It was then that Captain Lowe realized that a B-25 could actually fit on the deck of an aircraft carrier, and he developed the idea that perhaps medium-range bombers could be launched off the deck of an aircraft carrier. He ran this idea up the chain of command. And that's how it began. At 8:20 in the morning on April 18th, 650 nautical miles off the coast of Japan, the first of 16 B-25 bombers launched off the deck of the USS Hornet. At the controls of that very first aircraft to leave the USS Hornet was Lieutenant Colonel James H. Doolittle. Next to him in the co-pilot seat is the gentleman we're going to speak with today, at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole. Colonel Cole, Dick Cole, welcome to American Warrior, sir.
Thank you.
And I got to tell you, it is just, I'll say it once, but it is such an honor to have you on our show, and thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you very much.
And you're speaking to us from the lovely town of, well, just outside of San Antonio, Comfort, Texas?
Well, not exactly. I live on 5 acres in Kendall County, which is a county north of San Antonio.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about you, sir. I mean, I think I can't imagine anybody is not familiar with the Doolittle Raiders. But tell us, let's get started just a little bit about your background, because I think that's part of the joy of this story is from the very beginning, you were born in Dayton. And from the very beginning, you had a love affair with flight. Is that correct?
That's correct. I had made up my mind early on that I was going to try to open all the doors that would get me into aviation. If not, I was going to be a forest ranger.
Well, that's kind of close, I guess. Now you, so you did go to school. Now your daughter, I will tell you right now, your daughter gave me some inside information on you, and she mentioned that when you were a kid, there was a field nearby called McCook Field, which I think was an experimental field, and you would get on your bike.
It was the first. I think it was the first Army Air Corps test base.
Well, she said you would get on your bike and ride 5 miles just to watch those planes fly.
Yes, I did.
And then you also made, you made model planes yourself, balsa wood planes, or?
Yes, I belonged to a club then called the Airplane Model League of America, which made rubber band powered airplanes.
And how did your planes fly? Pretty good?
Yeah, well, some of them did and some of them didn't.
That I'll come back to that later in the show, because there's a quote from General Doolittle that I really appreciated. It referred to the difference between pilots and engineers. But the history of service to our nation goes way, way back in your family. As I understand it, Dick, you had a great-grandfather, a grandfather that served in the Revolutionary War?
Yes, he was kind of like a corpsman, we call him today. General Washington had a ship in the area around Washington. I don't know exactly where it was, but it was a ship that they put prisoners on. And he administered to those prisoners while he was in the service.
Well, so the history goes deep. Sir, I want to start off, like I said, most folks hopefully know about the Raiders, but one of the best parts of this story for me, Dick, is the idea that I've been told that you actually, as growing up and as a kid, you kept a scrapbook about the adventures and the successes of Jimmy Doolittle as he was building his aviation career. And to me, I just find it wonderful that, you admired this man and then eventually ended up flying right next to him on such a famous mission.
Well, I've often wondered about that, but I did have a scrapbook that I kept that, from the pictures and information from the Dayton Daily News, and a lot of them included Colonel Doolittle, but they also included some of the other old-timers, Aker and Spatz, and some of the rest of them.
Okay, and so just reflecting on that, what is now, I've never flown, sir, so co-pilot is the left-hand seat or the right-hand seat?
It's in the right-hand seat was the co-pilot. The pilot sat on the left seat.
Okay. Now, you were actually in the Army Air Corps. I believe you enlisted in 1940.
That's correct.
And got commissioned. So you'd been in for just a little while when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred. What were your feelings, Dick, when you heard the news about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, first off, I had kind of been following what was taking place political-wise between countries, and then the other fellows in the squadrons that we were in, talked about it too, and we all kind of had the feeling that there was going to be a war sometime in the future, and so we were trying to take advantage of our training and get the best training we could.
Okay, I tell you what, sir, we're going to take a quick commercial break here, and then when we come back, I want to talk, really get up to speed on the mission and just what an amazing, amazing mission took place. Folks, if you would like to talk to one of the last, well, the only four surviving Doolittle Raiders, 98 years young, one of my personal heroes, Colonel Dick Cole, give us a call, 751-1041. We're live here on American Warrior.
Those
those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
We're back, folks. We're joined by a... I almost said it, sir. I apologize. I almost said a piece of history. We're joined by one of the four remaining surviving Doolittle Raiders. At the time, Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole, who was the co-pilot in the plane flown by General Doolittle, the very first plane off that carrier on the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo, 4 months after the outset of World War, after the U.S. was pulled into World War II. And I tell you, we've got Christine. Hold on just a second. I want to kind of introduce this segment here before you talk with Dick Cole. But you know, that was the subject of a famous movie, and Dick, several movies, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. I had heard or I read somewhere that you never saw that film. Is that true, sir?
I never saw it or viewed it completely. I've seen parts of it. I was still overseas when the film was made, so I didn't pick up on it.
And who do you know who played you in the film?
Sir?
Do you know which actor played you in the movie?
I don't think so. It was on about the crew that Dave Thatcher and some of the other guys were on.
Okay.
It wasn't about the first airplane.
Okay. Hey, Christine, we just lost you. Give us a call back. Now, one of the other movies, sir, that was made or that referenced this raid was, of course, Pearl Harbor, which just came out recently. Not at all accurate. You didn't have fighter pilots going out and being taught how to fly bombers. And that leads me to my next subject. This was an all-volunteer mission. But really, the reality was, you know, all the volunteers came from the 17th Bomb Group because you guys were really the only ones who were trained on flying the B-25. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, it's pretty accurate. There were other units that had the B-25, but they got their airplanes after we got ours, and we were actually the first group that had any training at all.
Okay. Now, I'm trying to picture in my mind's eye, sir, what that conversation went like. When you, was there a notice posted saying, hey, super secret, dangerous mission, sign up today? Or how did you first and some of your fellow crew members find out about this opportunity?
Well, in my case, we had just moved to Columbia, South Carolina, and the base had not been finished. We were living in tents, and each squadron had a bulletin board in front of the command tent, and you were required to read it at least once a day. The day I saw it, there was a list there that I don't remember. There were other names on the list, and I read it, and I put my name on the list.
And you had no idea what you're getting into, huh?
No, but that goes with the territory and the job.
Well, there you go, sir. And I hear that from the men and women serving in the military today, even. Now, in researching and preparing for this show, Colonel, I read a quote from General Doolittle sometime in that, you know, he was involved, as you well know, in the early days of aviation. He set several records, was really an innovator. I think he's the first person that developed the concept of instrumentation flying and the idea that a pilot can and should be able to fly just with instruments. Is that accurate?
That's true. He was up at Mitchell Field in New York. He had an observer in the front seat of the aircraft. He took off and made a complete pattern and back to landing without ever looking at the ground.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, I read one of his quotes. He said early on in flight, he said that he saw engineers as people that designed things that just plain old didn't work, and the engineers probably saw pilots as crazy people willing to go up there in this relatively newfound machine. Tell me what your thought was when you first found out that you would be flying a B-25 bomber off an aircraft carrier. Do you recall what went through your mind at that point in time?
Well, I think I was in the majority group, but I got to see this. I'm from Missouri. And after we got into the technique of the training, ground-wise, they had sent a young lieutenant from Pensacola by the name of Henry Miller to show us how to make a carrier takeoff. He was a very good instructor, and he was able to go through the 16 crews without any fatality.
Now, I think a lot of folks who don't really know World War II very well, sir, they may not realize that this was just, I mean, fresh right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, 4 months into World War II, and you and your fellow volunteers basically had 3 weeks to train to do something that had never been done before, to fly a bomber off an aircraft carrier. I guess you didn't even get all your training flights in. At which point in that, after you volunteer, you get selected, you got sent off to training, at which point were you told about what the actual mission was going to be? Was that not until you were at sea, or was it sometime before that?
All through the training and so forth, up to 2 days at sea, most of us did not know what we were going to do. And then 2 days at sea, the PA system came on and said, this force is bound for Tokyo. At that time, there was a lot of jubilation and so forth, and then things kind of settled down, and people began to think of what that meant. But nobody jumped ship or nobody backed out.
Well, that's a good thing. You don't want to jump off an aircraft carrier. I know that much. Now, as I understand it, sir, a B-25 up to that point required about 2,000 feet to get airborne. But you had some real crackerjack guys. Your daughter told me, I guess, Don Smith, he was able to lift off in only 289 feet?
Yes. Most of them got off in plenty of time that was where they could have gotten off of the carrier.
Mm-hmm. Now, how well did you know Davy Jones?
Oh, he was in one of the squadrons, and I knew him pretty well.
Okay, well, most folks may not know. I think he achieved the rank of general, and he spent his last few years here in Tucson, Arizona. And I've always wanted to ask this question, and maybe you can answer it for me. Being an Army Air Corps pilot, did anybody ever give him a hard time about having a Navy name like Davy Jones?
I never heard him say anything like that, but somebody somewhere along the line, he probably did have to face that kind of a verbal problem.
Well, I suppose it's better than being in the Navy. I wouldn't want a guy named Davy Jones on my ship, I suppose. That's probably bad mojo. So coming back to the training, sir, as far as selecting the crews, you literally, like you said, you were in the right seat with General Doolittle. Did he select his crew for his aircraft specifically, or was it one of those things that just happened, or how did you end up as his co-pilot?
Well, this is where Lady Luck enters the scene. I was crewed up with another pilot, and we had started training. And he became ill and was disqualified. And after that happened, boy, the rest of the crew and myself talked it over. They still wanted to go, and I still wanted to go. So I went to the operations officer as an emissary and told him we still wanted to go. At that time, Colonel Doolittle came in, and he just took the pilot's seat, and that's how we got to be on his crew.
Well, it sounds like he got to be on your crew, sir.
Well, I don't know. That's a little far-stretched.
Listen, in talking about preparing for the mission, you'd mentioned that morale was pretty high when you learned about what your target was intended to be. I read something that there were some medals. I think they were called Japanese friendship medals that some of the crew members attached to the bombs. Did you witness that, or can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, we all witnessed it. What happened is that there were two or three officers on the Hornet that had been stationed in Japan as in an attaché or a mission or something. Anyway, while they were there, the Japanese gave them some medals for whatever they accomplished, and they happened to give those back to Colonel Doolittle, who pinned them on some of the bombs that we were going to drop.
Okay. Well, sir, we're about to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to talk to Colonel Cole, one of the Doolittle Raiders, give us a call, 751-1041. We're live here on American Warrior. Colonel Cole is joining us from Texas. Colonel, stick around, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the preparation and then the mission itself. What a harrowing mission. We'll be right back.
Who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And we're back here on American Warrior with Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole. Colonel Cole was the co-pilot of the very first aircraft, the first plane off the deck of the USS Hornet on April 18th, 1942, as the 16 B-25 bombers headed to Japan. Shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Colonel Cole, we had a caller, yeah. Christine called, and she didn't want to go on the air. She just wanted to say God bless you for all you did during the war. And we have another caller, Lori, who's got a question for you. Lori, what's your question for Colonel Cole?
Hi, Lieutenant Colonel Cole. Have you received your Congressional Medal of Honor?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
Colonel, her question was, have you received the Congressional Medal of Honor?
No, Colonel Doolittle received the Congressional Medal of Honor, which he rightly should. And the rest of the crews were given the Distinguished Flying Cross.
There was a bill last year making it through the Senate. It was Senate Bill 381. And I was fortunate to meet one of the young girls. She was 17 years old, who was going from congressional office to congressional office when we were back in D.C. last summer for the Teenage Republicans, trying to get people to sign on to this bill so that the last four remaining Doolittle Raiders would receive their congressional gold medal. And I didn't know whether it had been awarded yet or not, but that bill was making its way through Congress.
Well, just offhand, I would not be happy receiving anything unless the other crews were awarded the same thing.
Absolutely, sure. Well, we thank you for your service and the freedoms that you have allowed for us.
And, well, thanks for your question.
And thanks for your call, Lori. Hey, folks, if you go on Google and look up the Doolittle Raiders website, I believe there's a link there where you can sign a petition to help to ask Congress to give all the Doolittle Raiders, award them the Congressional Medal of Honor, and certainly well deserved. Colonel Cole, coming back to our discussion, getting into the mission itself, beyond just the craziness of flying a bomber off the deck of an aircraft carrier, there were some modifications that were made to the aircraft in order for you to be able to accomplish this mission. There were some extra fuel tanks, I believe, that were put in. One of the most interesting things I found is they removed the lower gun turret off the bomber and actually installed some fake guns in the tail section of the plane. Is that true history?
Well, it's true. Ross Greening, one of the pilots, suggested that putting two broomsticks sticking out of the tail cone on the airplane might discourage an enemy fighter. The other thing was that we removed the lower turret and replaced it with a gasoline tank of about 65 gallons. And when we started on the mission, there were 10 5-gallon cans in the back of the aircraft that the crew chief could dump into that tank, because we knew that one of the most critical things in the mission would be the fuel problem.
So that might have been the first incidence of midair refueling, maybe, huh?
Yeah, by the crew chief.
Yeah, a lot of historical firsts. Now, the plan was for you all to launch when you were 500 nautical miles off the coast of Japan, but the task force, if you will, was spotted by a Japanese picket ship, so you had to launch early, and I think you were about actually 650 miles out when you launched.
That's true.
At that point, sir, you know, there was a plan. Obviously, I don't want to say it was a one-way mission, but the plan was to fly, hit your target, and then land in China so that the crews and the aircraft could be recovered to fight another day. But when you launched at 650 nautical miles, what sort of thought was going on in the cockpit between you and Colonel Doolittle about, well, you know, that's 150 miles difference is a big change?
Well, all the crews knew when we had the launch early that the fuel was going to be a problem. The word that it was going to be a one-way mission, I don't know or understand how that came about. I didn't feel that it was any more than a suicide mission than the guys in England taking off going over Germany, because they didn't know where they were going to get back. So I guess we just passed it off as a routine. What's going to happen deal.
Now, just one other thing I'd like to ask, sir. You guys only had 3 weeks of training to prepare for this mission, but when you left the deck of the USS Hornet that morning of the mission, that was actually the first time any of you had really, I mean, you'd practiced it, but you'd never actually launched off a carrier before.
That's right. And it also was the first time any of us had ever had any flights that was going in to end up in a combat situation.
Wow. Okay. That's not something one's heard about. Interesting.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Yes.
So tell us what that was like. You were airborne approximately how long from when you left the carrier before you were over your target?
We got off of the carrier a good distance back from the bow of the ship. And we took off and circled over the carrier. The Navy people gave us a chalkboard heads up of a course to Japan. And in about 4 hours and 10 minutes, we were over Japan. On the way into Japan, we passed underneath a Japanese four-engine flying boat. We veered off course two or three times so we wouldn't fly over freighters who we considered that may have armament on them. But we arrived over Japan in good shape right at high noon on the 18th.
Now, but the plan changed a little bit, though. Was the original plan to launch at night and arrive at daybreak?
Yes, we were supposed to launch at night on the 19th, fly all night, arrive over Japan or China in the morning, gas up, and fly on into western China to a base where the American volunteer group were based.
And it didn't quite turn out that way.
No, that's right.
So you mentioned you flew under a Japanese plane, but you never had to use those broomsticks in the tail section.
No, we were never jumped. We saw numerous airplanes above us as we approached Tokyo, and the only action that we had was that we, on the end of the bombing run, we had some ACAC that jostled us around, but it wasn't accurate.
Well, and for those who aren't familiar, ACAC is anti-aircraft fire. So what your target, sir, was, what was your target on the mission?
Our target was northwest Tokyo. We had incendiary bombs. And according to the plan, when flying over there at night, we were to light up Tokyo and also give the following airplanes some sort of reference to help them get there.
And did that go as planned?
Not quite.
Not quite. What actually happened?
On the morning of the 18th, we intercepted a Japanese fishing boat that had a long range radio, and we couldn't avoid it, and Admiral Halsey elected to go ahead and issue orders to have that thing sunk, which they did. But before it sunk, they got a message to Japan that we were in the area. And the people in Japan decided to wait until there was some sort of confirmation, which was never going to come. Sunk. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're still here. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah.
Colonel Cole, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, keep going with your story.
Okay. The ship was named Nita Maru, and like I said, we couldn't avoid it, so Admiral Halsey issued orders for the one of the destroyers to sink it, which they did. And it wasn't before the fishing boat got off a message to Japan, and they kind of ignored it, and so that was to our favor.
Sure. Sure. Now, for the listeners listening, we had, even despite Mr. Marconi's greatest efforts, radio is not a perfect technology yet. I think maybe that Japanese fishing boat is still around trying to intercept your phone call, Colonel Cole. But tell us now, so you flew in, and I think it's important for people to recognize this is not, you know, this is not an autopilot. I mean, you guys are both, it takes both of you to fly and to work that aircraft, particularly at the altitudes you were flying. Did you go in on the deck as much as possible, or what altitudes were you flying at?
Most of the highest altitude we were flying was about 200 feet all the way to Japan. After we pulled up to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs, we went back down to that altitude and flew the rest of the flight to China at low altitude.
And I'm sorry, sir, you were flying at 200 feet from, wow. For how long?
And we had no autopilot. We had to do it manually.
Sure, sure. Those were the days. So tell us, I tell you what, folks, if you're listening, we're going to skip the next commercial break because we just got such a great guest here, and I want to make sure we get every opportunity. If you have a question, give us a call. 751-1041 is the number here at The Truth. Now, Colonel, you delivered your payload, and at that point you had to, you're trying to get to China or to a safe landing zone. There were landing zones that were designated, but was it pretty obvious to the crew that you weren't going to make it that far? And at which point did you decide, okay, we're going to have to just bail out?
About midway through the flight toward China, Hank Potter, the navigator, passed a note up that we were going to be about 180 miles short of the coast when we had run out of fuel. but the little be known to us, the big warm front that caused all the weather over China created a wind called kamikaze wind that blew from west to east. And we didn't know that we had picked up about a 35-knot tailwind until we arrived at the figures that Hank had given us. We were still had fuel, and that's when we realized we had a tailwind, which carried us all the way into China.
Now, you don't think, for our younger listeners, sir, you don't think that maybe that had something to do with the fact that your navigator was called Harry Potter? Oh, Henry Potter. Okay, I'm a little bit off. But so now, one of the things I was reading when I researched it, I saw a letter that you had written that described what happened to you. So the crew bails out. Who was the last man out of the plane?
Colonel Doolittle was the last man.
That would make sense. And you actually, he hit the ground. I guess he ended up in a rice paddy, but you ended up spending the night in a tree.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we all had to bail out in the middle of the storm, and it was socked in clear to the ground. And once you get safely out of the airplane, you begin to wonder what you're going to hit when you end up at the bottom of your jump. I was able to avoid that because my chute drifted over a pine tree, and I did not hit the ground. I ended up about 12 feet off of the ground. But I couldn't see the ground, so I elected to stay in the tree until morning, and maybe it would be a storm had moved on then, and I could see what was going on.
Well, it turns out that was pretty smart. I in my research of the crew, there were 80 crew members on the mission. Some did not survive, and as I understand it, one of the crew members who was killed was actually fell into a ravine or fell into a cliff, off a cliff or something, as he was trying to maneuver there in the dark.
Yeah, that was Bain, and he landed in a very rough part of the country. It was very mountainous and rocky and so forth, and unfortunately, he didn't make it.
Well, I tell you, sir, I've got, Tucsonans, I guess, are kind of a shy group. They're calling. None of them want to go on the air, but all of them want to tell you thank you for your service, and they really appreciate you doing the show. Let's move forward a little bit. So you spent the night in the tree, and then you found your way to the Chinese, I don't know if rebels is the right word, but the Chinese forces there, and you ended up linking up with at least General Doolittle. But did all of the original five members of the crew end up back together then at that point?
All of us were back together the next night. I found Colonel Doolittle. He was the first one to be picked up by the Chinese. And I found them after my arrival. Some other Chinese brought in Paul Leonard and Fred Bremer and Hank Potter. And so we were all together the next night, but we were separated from the rest of the crews by a mountain range. So we did not see anybody else until we arrived at a place called Hanyang after we rode all kinds of transportation and so forth, walked in about 10 days. We ended up in Hanyang, and the 10th Air Force sent a C-47 in to pick us up and take us to Kunming, which is the provisional capital of China at that time.
Okay, Jack, Colonel, let me interrupt you for a second. We've got Jack. You're not shy. You want to thank the Colonel on the air for his service?
Yeah, I heard about this mission. Didn't see too much of it. I did see the movie. But, you know, it was incredible. You're a brave and you're an awesome American hero. and I really appreciate you doing the service that you did for our country.
Well, that was our job, and you had to take the good with the bad.
Well, thank you very much.
Jack, thanks for your call, and thanks for listening to American Warrior. Colonel Cole, one of the stories or what you hear is immediately after the mission, Colonel Doolittle thought he was in for a court-martial. He kind of figured the whole thing was a failure. Do you recall or can you share with kind of what the morale was of the crew when you got back together initially there, when the Chinese got you back together in one place? What was going through Colonel Doolittle's mind?
I can only share from the standpoint of what Paul Leonard, the crew chief, told Colonel Doolittle. The Chinese took Paul and Colonel Doolittle up to the plane site where it crashed. Colonel Doolittle was very dejected because he had lost all the airplanes, and he didn't know where the crews were or anything about them. He suggested to Paul that he might end up in Leavenworth. And at that time, Paul told him, and said, "No, sir." He said, "They're going to give you the Congressional Medal of Honor and promote you to Brigadier General."
And that's what happened.
And that's what happened.
Hey, Dick, I've got maybe a new friend of yours on the line. John is calling. And, John, I think you met Colonel Cole back in Dayton for the final ceremonial toast, if this is the right John.
Yes, Colonel Cole and Ben, this is me. I just wanted to ask you again. I've asked you several times. I just love the answer. I know that you've flown many, many airplanes in your career, and all the way up through jets in the Vietnam era, and I'd like for you to tell the individuals out there who's listening what your favorite airplane is, and I want to thank you and Cindy again for coming to Tucson. Happy contrails.
Well, my favorite airplane is all of them. I did not serve in Vietnam.
Your favorite airplane is one that takes off and lands.
That's correct.
Okay, John, thanks for your call to American Warrior. We've got Ellen calling. Ellen, what's your question for Colonel Cole?
Hello, Lieutenant Colonel Cole. This is Ellen. I met you while you were here in Tucson. I would love for you to share with us what were your thoughts as you were bailing out, and if you had practiced the bailout before, and if you had any injuries from that bailout.
Well, I have to tell you that the few minutes before we bailed out, and standing in an airplane that flying over someplace you'd never been, that was the most scary time as far as I was concerned. But bailing out was a lot better than the alternative, and you took the ladders. He took the bailing out, and fortunately, most of us were able to bail out successfully. And in our crew, we all bailed out successfully with no injuries.
Good. No black eyes?
I'm sorry?
No black eyes?
She said no black eyes, sir?
Okay.
I guess not. Hey, Ellen, thanks for your call. Ellen and John, thank you so much also for what you did to help bring Colonel Cole here. And Colonel, I tell you, the time just flies. But before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about something that many Tucsonans probably aren't aware of. And the Doolittle Raiders have become legendary, and there is a ceremony that the Raiders have been performing for years now. And there's a specific Tucson tie. Some people may be aware that there's silver goblets, each goblet engraved with the name of each of the 80 crew members. And on occasion, after the war, the crews would get together and you would toast to the members that had gone by, who had passed away. But a lot of folks don't know those goblets actually were commissioned and donated to the Raiders by the citizens of Tucson. And so there's a direct tie between our community and your group.
That's true. I was not at the ceremony at Tucson when they were given to the group. I was overseas. But for a while they were at their Air Force Academy, but now they're at the Wright-Patterson Museum.
And, sir, we've got just about 3 minutes left. I tell you, I've got callers telling us to continue in on to the next hour, but our next guest is sitting next to me, and she's pretty tough, so we may not do that. But to the last toast, there are four surviving Raiders, and God bless you, sir, for what you've done. But the last toast just took place this November where you finally uncorked the bottle of cognac, of Hennessy cognac, that had been handed down from Colonel Doolittle. Can you share with us what your thoughts were on that occasion?
There was supposed to be some sort of a difficulty in uncorking the bottle, and it turned out to be true. The wax that had been on the bottle for years was about a quarter of an inch thick, and it was pretty difficult to get it to open up. Fortunately, Tom Casey, our business manager, helped me out, and we were able to get the cork out and proceed with the toast.
Now, sir, you're being your humble self again. I want to remind, if the listeners don't know, that bottle of cognac was vintage 1896, so that wax was on there more than just a couple of years.
Yeah.
That was probably about, like, cement by the time you got to it. Sir.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Sir,
maybe I was to get it.
I tell you, I just want to thank you again for your service. Do you have any last thoughts? I mean, this really is a very unique opportunity. I can't tell you how proud I am to have you here on American Warrior. What would you like to leave our listeners with? What thoughts in America?
I would like to leave with the country that to make sure that we don't get unprepared by not paying enough attention to our dollars and cents that go into the military.
Well, sir, we are a few years apart, but we agree on that. So, Colonel Cole, thank you for your service. God bless you, sir. Thank you for being on American Warrior, and come back to Tucson anytime.
Okay, I'm happy to help out if I did. Bye.
Bye-bye. Folks, I hope you enjoyed that. We'll be right back with a great episode of Daily Mail. Stick around.